pandas.
Pandas.
I am giving a shout out to pandas. There is no reason for you to exist, and yet you exist anyway, which means you are actually demonstrating God's infinite love for the world. Go pandas.
Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is titled Zombie Jesus, a title we will explain as we go along.
I hope so.
To bear with us. A conversation about how theology interacts with pop culture, and in particular, certain kinds of imaginative worlds that are created by books and movies and things like that, and whether it can, in fact, reflect God, theological themes, and even draw us closer to God. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Renee Kohler-Ryan, my co-host and professor in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame.
Hello, Peter.
And by our special guest, Matthew Tan, a lecturer, academic, author, and editor of the blog Awkward Asian Theologian. Welcome, Matthew.
Morning.
And he's also the author of Redeeming Flesh, The Way of the Cross with Zombie Jesus, or as I have titled it, Zombie Jesus. We should begin by defining what we're talking about here. What do we mean by zombies? Now, we're referring to a whole genre of imaginative worlds where there are things we call undead, and the undead include things such as zombies, vampires, sometimes werewolves are included in this list. And who have I missed? Maybe Frankenstein-style monsters, in things like this, sort of the where something unnaturally returns from like a body animates, or there's an unnatural return from a deathly situation, usually in a horror kind of situation.
That's correct.
Is that a fair definition?
Yep, that's correct.
Anyone I've missed in that whole?
Maybe admin workers, but I don't know that.
I'm tipping that one to get cut. Okay. Right. Sometimes I feel like a zombie at work, but that's not the same thing.
That's just a lack of coffee.
Yeah, it probably is.
Admin gives me joy.
Admin gives you joy. Now he is. He's role-playing the zombie at the moment, yes.
So I get joy from admin.
This is kidding. We're a bit too lively for zombies at this point. Now, one of the interesting things is that this whole pop culture genre, this undead genre, has really, it used to be that to read these kinds of books, I used to have to read them well outside of the normal culture. I had to go looking for these in quite obscure bookstores when I was a teenager. This probably reveals a misspent youth. But this idea of life after death is a fascinating one, which has just now started to become a really big thing in pop culture. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the fascination with zombies pretty much becomes mainstream with the release of George Romero's movie Night of the Living Dead, which was released in 1968, and then the sequel, which is Dawn of the Dead, in 1978.
Right.
So there's a very specific form of zombie that we are looking at, which many people kind of colloquially call the Romero zombie.
Oh, really?
The reason for this being that there actually are many different types of zombies.
Right. This is all fictional, by the way. Just for the listener, what? In case you're looking out your window checking for the zombies. Go ahead.
Yes.
It's pretty dark in here.
Fictional. So the type of zombie that George Romero focuses on are the ones that are reanimated corpses.
Right.
So these are people who have already died and have risen from the dead to walk the face of the earth pretty much forevermore.
Mm, usually without the same consciousness.
Usually without the same consciousness, or with the most basic biological drives.
Right.
At work.
Interesting you said biological, whereas it's often a supernatural theme to it.
Mm, that's right. But the Romero zombie has this very, very specifically biological drive associated with it.
Right.
We must not confuse this with, say, the 28 days or the 28 weeks later type of zombie, where you have living people infected by a virus that gets turned into a flesh-eating zombie.
That's World War Z.
That's World War Z and that kind of thing. So there's a very specific zombie that I'm referring to in this particular book.
Okay.
Matt, you actually wrote this book after giving a series of meditations to, was it seminarians?
That's
or
correct.
Priests? Yes. Mm-hmm. And I remember you telling me about this at the time, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, Matt. I wonder how their Holy Week's going to be. And I don't know if I ever followed up with you about how they responded to it. So was that an effective way of actually leading them into thinking about Holy Week and everything that follows from that?
Yeah, strangely enough, it did. Partly because it was sort of using a particular motif that is current to at least people in that generation. I mean, a lot. It's not to say that it actually communicated this equally effectively with every single person. Mm. But having said that, it did actually resonate with a good number of people.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is they've seen the shows, they're familiar with the genre, so they could connect with
correct.
It.
Yeah. There was this other part that I think was effective in that it just came out of absolutely out of left field.
Yeah.
So they were listening.
Yeah.
So and because of that, they were listening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to say it's not the way I begin my theology classes. So
to give it a bit of a background, part of the reason why I ended up talking about zombies to the seminarians wasn't actually by design. It actually came off the back of a blog post that I had written maybe a couple of months or even a few years before I think I may have entitled it Undead Jesus. This was in another blog.
Right.
No, it was called Death Drive Jesus. That was
okay.
I was asked to give the retreat. I agreed. And then I said, so what am I going to be talking about? I asked around and people said, why don't you just do stuff on zombies? And I go, yes. Yes, I will. And then the next thing I knew, I was giving a 3-day retreat
on zombies
to the seminarians to help us get into the mood for Holy Week.
Okay. So we probably need to placate our scandalized listeners at this point and explain the connection between zombies and theology.
Do I have to placate them?
No, I think you should make them think.
Yes, okay. So let's tease that out. So what was beneficial for the seminarians?
What was beneficial with the seminarians was the whole reflection on death.
Okay.
No, that was it.
Something about turning into flesh-eating monsters was really helpful in thinking about death.
It was helpful in helping them think about death, but also because the this particular type of zombie, the Romero zombie, is a creature that has risen from the dead. It is not just that we are focusing on death. It also is a focus on what it means to rise again from the dead.
Mm. Yes.
What it means to have immortality and what it means to actually live the life that you are living now.
Right.
Mm. In the face of your impending death.
Right. Mm.
And not only that, in the face of your impending immortality that will follow death.
Yeah, because that's the Walking Dead show often looks at this. It deals with people who are living, facing the possibility of an existence beyond, which is not necessarily the happiest of.
That's right. And what is interesting about the Walking Dead, which I love, is also the fact that many of the episodes in the Walking Dead actually take an explicitly theological turn.
Right. Precisely. Give us an example.
My favorite example is the inclusion of what I can only describe as a preacher,
right,
as one of the characters.
Oh, okay.
In this band of survivors. Interestingly, the explorations that take place in some of these episodes where the preacher takes center stage are episodes whereby the preacher actually struggles with what he understands to be God's providence, coming up against the horror of what is before him. Mm. There is also the question of how a person is meant to be hopeful in the face of that reality.
Yeah.
And there's also this question about the man of God struggling to maintain that hope and failing, because one of the what comes out in many of these episodes, until much later, at least in the early phases of this preacher's biography, is that this is a preacher who fails dramatically.
Right.
At one point, he actually betrays the people that he travels with.
And his own beliefs, presumably.
And his own beliefs as well.
Right.
Yeah, so it then leads to moments of repentance.
Right.
Moments of soul searching. And so that basically stands out for me.
Okay. It's always interesting when they put religious motifs into movies and pop culture, but I'm really intrigued with, I mean, if you put it in what is supposed to be, it's a parallel universe, but it's supposed to be based on our universe. And so this preacher presumably has Christian-style beliefs, and then he's confronted by this bizarre reality where things are coming back from the dead. How does he actually cope with that?
That's right.
Yeah.
And in many instances, at least in the early stages of this character's biography, he doesn't.
Right.
You know, he's so...
In fairness, I'm not sure I would.
Like, yeah, the absolutely.
Zombies come out, I'm not sure I would do so
absolutely,
well.
That would never happen to me.
Well, we've been talking about zombies a lot, and I mentioned other kinds of undead. Let's briefly foray into other types. And one of the more popular ones at the moment is vampires. Ever since Bram Stoker's Dracula and other forms of vampire movies, I've been a little bit fascinated with it. And often it's interesting how they do a different take on the vampires, but everything comes back to several similar things. They're afraid of the light and sunlight in particular. Holy symbols seem to have this big effect on them, and they drink blood. Mm-hmm. And so there's this sort of life blood thing going on.
And in Bram Stoker, there's a real concentration on holy water and the Eucharist.
Yes.
As well, which I remember being really fascinated by when I read it, which is kind of written out of some vampire stuff. But Buffy the Vampire Slayer still has her crosses and her holy water, and that's pretty important stuff. The Eucharist might have been taking things a little bit too far, but really that solid religious imagery. How does that relate back to that idea of redeeming flesh? Because that it's a really Catholic theme, the incarnate flesh and the Eucharist and
also,
the sacramental life.
You notice that zombies are eating flesh and vampires are drinking blood. It's the flesh and blood of the resurrection.
It's really I think in Buffy it's like it's always the blood. That's the theme that keeps on coming back. I watch Buffy way too much. But, or if that's possible, I don't know.
You just admitted that online.
That's all right. I'm sort of proud of it.
You're owning
I'm usually not very with it, but I feel like with Buffy I could hold my own.
Fair enough. With regards to the vampire, there was, I believe, the Anglican theologian, which is one of my favorite theologians, a man by the name of Graham Warren, he's Regius Professor of Divinity out at Oxford. He made a point in his book, Cities of God, about vampires.
Oh, really?
If I remember this correctly, one of the lines that he spoke about was he said that the vampire is an anti-Eucharistic figure.
Wow.
He stands out as an anti-Eucharistic figure because he has to imbibe the blood of others in order for this, you know, in order to maintain some semblance of immortality.
And yet he's possessed by that, the need for perpetuation. It's almost driven by that hunger.
Correct. Yeah. And yet at the same time he is also by the nature of the fact that he is a vampire, he is also dead. So you have this sort of like dead figure drinking from the living so that he might have some semblance of life.
Right.
Only this life is a kind of half-life.
Right.
Yeah.
He sort of hovers between life and death on a constant basis.
Yes.
So in that respect, there is actually a reversal of the Eucharist, where instead of the dead forcibly taking life from the living, it is in contradistinction to the Eucharistic logic, whereby the living willingly give their lives for the sake of the dead so that the dead may have life.
Yeah, and it brings them to life. Like the flesh and blood brings us to life.
Correct.
Yeah. Gives us Christ life.
And one of the points that I make in the book is that the zombie follows that logic. So in many respects, it is unique, but at another deeper level, it is actually following that kind of motif of the undead.
Right. Can I push this a little bit? Because the vampire thing perhaps has had slightly, you've talked about the Romero zombie as being a particular kind of zombie, and World War Z goes a different direction because it's slightly more scientific, in inverted commas, to talk about a disease version.
Correct.
But in the vampire area, we've had a fair range of different interpretations of vampirism, if you like, and if I dare raise that cursed name, the Twilight series, is a particular kind
of... I roll.
I just I just shuddered on just for the sake of our listeners.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing because it became a teen romance put into a vampire setting. And it, and a lot of parents I know were upset because it kind of normalized this sort of literally a sort of a niche horror genre as a kind of a, you know, an okay thing for teens. And now it's become, if you go into the teen book section in a bookshop, you'll see teen vampire romance is this kind of genre now, which is revolting in itself just because it's bad literature most of the time. But in terms of the Twilight thing, my beef with them, I didn't read them much, but my beef with it was twofold. Sparkling vampires, ew, and it just totally reverses and undermines the whole theme of the mythology of them. And they also, it turned into a kind of a polemic in my understanding for particular religious views, but it was still very theological.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by a Mormon. It seems to be a polemic, for example, for virtue of chastity. Like there's a kind of abstinence theme going through it. And also, if I can just briefly, grumpily mention that all the big bad vampires who come and try and tell off the good vampires are from Rome, of course. They're the conclave from Rome who come and sort of boss around, mm-hmm. and they're the bad guys. So did everyone get the message there?
I don't know.
I never get the message.
But, I mean, I've watched other popularized versions like the Underworld series some others around more recently. I mean, there's Interview with the Vampire. Was that the Tom Cruise one?
Yep.
These whole ideas of it being kind of a almost a sexy kind of thing. Mm. Is that just popularizing it, or is there still something theological there?
I think there is something theological there.
Right.
What I'm sort of detecting is a bit of a cultural turn. So you see a sort of shift in the way people treat the undead.
Right.
Whereas before, the undead were treated as an object of revulsion.
Yes.
Interestingly, it sort of coincided with the, the sort of, for want of a better term, loss of a even cultural religiosity in society. So that when society becomes less religious, the less the undead become seen as objects of revulsion. And
right.
then to the contrary, they become seen as objects of seduction.
Or fascination.
Mm. Precisely because as faith, an explicitly religious faith in an immortal God subsides, a cultural fascination with immortality increases.
Mm.
And so anything that that bears some semblance of immortality, particularly immortality after death, which is part of the reason why vampires and even, dare I say, zombies are included as well. These become objects of fascination,
right.
and or desire.
They're kind of a cultural manifestation of our fear of death.
Not just that they are cultural manifestations of our fear of death, but they also are manifestations of our desire for immortality beyond death.
Right.
So it's not simply that we fear dying, but that we actually want to have something beyond death. It's just that because we do no longer have the religiosity to give the vocabulary for that,
right?
We are now relying on other things to give that vocabulary, in this right. case, the undead.
That's a really interesting point. But I wonder if it's not... I mean, the argument came up in my head as you were talking.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just us wanting there to be an afterlife in a sort of a wishful thinking? And most people talk about religion, when they're cynical about religion, they talk about religion as being this fanciful hope that we live beyond. And what we really have to do is be grown-ups and just acknowledge the oblivion of beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that we have an innate sense that we're not limited to this particular short existence and that we're trying to find, as you said, the vocabulary to move into that sphere. Mm.
I would actually go further. I would actually say that we are sort of hardwired not simply to be immortal, but to actually live our immortality during our mortal lives.
Right.
So there is a sort of, we sort of desire not simply immortality out there.
Mm.
We actually desire that that infinity, that immortality to break into our histories. In fact, what we are, essentially what I'm saying is that we are hardwired to desire heaven on earth.
Right.
So do you think it's more than the way that some people talk about, say, Thomas Aquinas's idea of the natural desire for a supernatural end? Mm-hmm. It's actually a natural desire for the supernatural in everyday life that
That's
you're
right.
talking about?
That's yeah. right. And okay. it's not, I don't think that actually runs across Aquinas's point.
Yeah.
I
think they work together quite well.
I think
well.
They work yeah. together quite yeah. well. Yeah. yeah. Mm.
Even push it further and say it's not just about the supernatural coming into this life, but that even in imagining a life after death, that it's a fleshly life.
That's right.
That it's a physical incarnation. So in other words, it's a resurrection.
So is this a way of understanding as a theologian what happens when we deny that there are these supernatural dimensions to reality?
Absolutely. Mm. And also when we deny the sort of, I suppose, for the want of a better term, the cultural currency that theological vocabulary has when we try to make sense of life after death or even death itself.
Mm. Yeah, this is what I find really exciting about your work, Matt, that you can look at these cultural phenomena and you can find the theology in there, which as a philosopher, I'm like, what is going on? But, but just the imagination to be able to say, no, okay, Renee and everyone else, you know, there's something going on here, and actually it's really rich and it's really meaningful. You have to pull it out and think about it, but actually this theological dimension is not missing from anything.
And in answer to those people who are wondering what the heck we're doing, why don't we just study the resurrection? Why don't we just study pure theology? Mm. Well, my first answer, even though I've got theological answers, my first answer is because this is so cool.
it's really fun.
That's right.
Fictional tales, especially ones which go into a kind of a parallel reality where the rules are slightly different, draw us into questions to do with this reality. We see it with things like Star Trek or sci-fi, like 2001 A Space Odyssey, these kinds of fictional things which don't exist in this universe, but because the rules are slightly changed, we can think about our own reality with a bit more clarity because we're dealing with thought experiments, really.
Absolutely.
Advanced thought experiments.
And to add to that, we are now sort of living in an age that is more open to exploring all of these questions.
Yeah.
That is more open to exploring theological questions, even though they are not aware of it.
Hmm.
We are sort of going into what Graham Ward describes in his book, The Politics of Discipleship, as a post-material age.
Really?
He says,
what does he mean by that?
In the post-material, post-materialism is, he describes as a sort of broad phenomenon that brings together two things. One is there is a sort of smudging of the border between the natural and the supernatural. He sort of regards this sort of sharp distinction between the earthly and the heavenly as a very recent thing.
Mm. Right.
And that this border is breaking down.
Yes,
right. Mm. We are quite literally tearing down this wall between the natural and the supernatural.
Mm.
So because of that, even as we are blatantly materialistic in our cultural practices, we nonetheless still have at the back of our minds a sort of desire for the heavenly, which we cannot help but put into words, whether it is in music, whether it is in the way we advertise our goods. I still remember a sports channel that shall remain unnamed having this massive ad on a bus that said, and it was advertising its sports channel, and it said, some religions only have one God, we have thousands.
Oh.
The implication being that because we have thousands, it's therefore better.
Right.
So on the one hand, it's actually, this. I found it fascinating because on the one hand, it is actually using very materialistic logic that just because there's more of something, it's therefore
right.
better.
Yeah.
Yet at
yeah.
the same time, it still cannot avoid the use of God talk.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that was one aspect of post-materialism. The other aspect of post-materialism that Graham Ward talks about is the fact that when we pursue things, we no longer want to pursue things simply because it satisfies some material end. So I do something, or I work my job, or I engage in a social action simply because it helps me pay the bills.
Right.
Right. There's a sort.
Or makes me rich.
Or because it makes me rich.
Yeah.
Right. There's a sort of, I recall this meme somebody put up on Facebook the other day where it says, you are meant to do more than pay bills and die. And
what?
Yep. I know.
That is weird.
And that accounts for a fair amount of my day.
That's right.
The dying part?
Mostly when I pay bills.
That's right.
A little death to self.
Yes.
And what post-materialism actually, you know, what it actually entails is that when I engage in any particular action, I'm actually doing so out of the pursuit of some kind of interest that does not involve material gain.
Right.
So I do it for a social cause, or I do it for the for the sake of the poor, the environment,
right?
Some members of the downtrodden,
yes,
etc. That atmosphere, right, is something that opens up the, how shall I put it? It opens a person up to receiving ways of thinking, vocabularies that escape, crassly materialistic logics.
It's interesting, we're so comfortable, and I know we're not comfortable in individual ways, and we're all uncomfortable for various reasons, but in Western society, we've been quite comfortable. We aren't afflicted by life-threatening crises every day in the same way as some other cultures are.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this movie, and it's not just the zombie movies or the vampire movies, it's often post-apocalyptic idea,
yep,
sort of that, mm-hmm, whole world thing,
yep,
that presses upon, it almost like it's put humanity into a pressure cooker, and then tries to look at what happens when you put people under this sort of pressure,
mm,
where everything's at stake, where the primal urges of humanity are tested against virtue. And there's an attraction to that idea that what happens when they're all under this immense amount of pressure.
Mm. And there's also this fascination with exploring what the limits of human ability are.
Yeah.
And what happens to it when that human ability breaks down.
Mm.
This was a theme that was explored in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Mm.
Right.
And this is to sort of go back to an earlier point about what happens when we as a culture sort of lose that religiosity. I explore in the book this theme that you see in English literature around the turn of the 20th century, that as religiosity fades, it's not just simply that you have a greater celebration of human achievements and the products of the human intellect, but you also have hidden within that an anxiety of what happens when things go wrong.
Mm. Right.
Is our ability, our human ability, really as limitless as we make it out to,
yeah,
be? And Frankenstein was one of the first explorations or literary explorations of that limit. And it, of course, gives the answer an emphatic no.
Is this related to ghost stories? Because ghost stories go back a bit further than Frankenstein. So there's if you go back into some of the older ghost stories, they're quite scary.
Absolutely.
And they usually explore, and ones at least I've read of the older ones, where someone who's living has messed with something they shouldn't.
Yes.
And then the supernatural consequences of that. That's played out a lot in modern movies as well.
Mm.
But this fascination with our actions now having eternal, like significant consequences beyond.
Yeah.
Is that part of the same deal?
That's part of the same deal.
Right.
Yeah. Edgar Allan Poe
talks
about this in his short story, The House of the Fall of Usher.
Yeah.
Where a man sort of is haunted by and also attacked by his seemingly dead sister.
Right.
It's sort of left unclear as to whether he actually successfully murdered the sister,
right,
or whether he actually just did a botch up job of it. there are some very sordid details in that book that involve he did to the sister.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that's happened in the zombie range is that it's also spawned quite a lot of computer games.
Mm.
And these are virtual reality style of computer games where you are in the first person and dealing with in the most basic of them, is just waves and waves of zombies coming at you, and you just carve them up. So, and generally speaking, it's just a hack and slash kind of idea. I think Left 4 Dead is the main series, but there's lots of others in that genre. Left 4 Dead actually got banned in Australia because it's too graphic. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up arguing that because these bodies were zombies, not humans, even though they looked human in every way, that wasn't the same as violence against humans. It's an interesting thing, particularly when we're talking about the theological connection between the sort of the resurrection type in zombies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
I just make one quick point about this whole question about the undead coming back to haunt us when we do something bad? Because that actually is something else at play with regards to the zombie, because when it comes to the zombie, it is not simply those who have done something bad that die under the tsunami of flesh eating. It's actually the innocent that die just as easily, if not the innocent actually constitute more of the victims than anybody who has.
You kind of have to be a bit badass to survive the zombie apocalypse.
That's right. And the thing is, and this is actually explored in one episode of The Walking Dead. In a very early episode in the first season, one of the characters has a daughter that dies and becomes a zombie.
Right.
And there's a sort of moment between two characters, she and another survivor,
right?
Whereby she starts reminiscing about how good her daughter was, and one of the characters turns to her and says, "Is that why she died?" And to which the mother says, "Yes."
Right. Interesting.
The good die young.
The good die young, and the good die quicker.
That's an interesting thing. This is the point. The genre invokes or provides us with an environment or a setting where all of these key questions can play themselves out. But what about the people who say, sure, but can't we have this same sort of test of human virtue and character in a war movie or in another movie of maybe the sci-fi thing or another context where we don't have to deal with the ugliness of the undead?
Because war is so genteel.
Yeah, you can't. It's like alien movies, you know. Alien movies have been horrible for some time.
I think part of the reason why the undead or any other kind of fantasy genre is invoked in exploring of these things is precisely because they already break the bounds of credibility.
Right.
A war movie is... yes, okay, in some respects it is fictional.
But they're aiming for realism, aren't they?
But they aim for realism in a way that you don't see with fantasy genres.
They still want the fantasy to be believable, though.
Correct. And yet at the same time, it's already premised upon an incredible premise.
Yes, true.
Okay. Does it get rid of some of the problems that we have with the intricacies of moral decision making? Like, if you're dealing with a zombie who's just driven by some kind of biological need, then you can, and they're ugly, and you know, enemy, no problem. Whereas in more nuanced narratives, you'd be saying, well, I can kind of see that there was a motivation here that is still distinctly human, and it's aiming for a certain kind of good. You can't have the or the anti-hero in the same way.
Sure, sure. This is part of the reason why I love particularly The Walking Dead, because it explores those very themes.
Yeah.
There is one scene that I recall where, again, one of the characters has a brother who eventually becomes a zombie. And what is, there are no words exchanged, of course. But the thing is that, you know, this brother is abusive. This brother is a real bad guy. And he becomes a zombie. And he then sees this character and then starts shambling towards him with the intention of eating him. What the character then does is that he begins weeping before before his zombie. Wow. And he tries pushing him away. He doesn't try to kill him. He just tries pushing him away.
Yeah.
And then eventually he realizes that there is no way that he can get his brother to stop.
Right. Yeah.
And so he eventually has to kill him like any other zombie.
Right.
So there is a, even though it's not put into words, there's a sort of dramatic exploration.
Yeah.
Does the does the body, though dead, have any dignity left in it?
That's a good point. And I think that's the difference between, I mentioned aliens before. There's a difference between putting humans in the pressure cooker of being attacked by aliens and how do they react, and having them attacked by essentially other humans, in at least there's some element of humanity, at least perceived, still there, and they have to react to it. And the emotional sort of tension in those things is with that person's life.
Correct. This is played out quite a number of times, where you start to see familiar characters becoming, you know, zombies themselves. Mm. So it's just that that particular scene sort of stood out for me.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing too, to go back to the issue of ethical questions, when you look at The Walking Dead, most of the ethical questions do not arise in the context of the relationship between the living and the dead. They actually are questions that arise between survivors.
Right.
How do you treat survivors when you are faced with the prospect of death, especially imminent death that you cannot avoid?
Yeah.
And that is really where the ethical questions arise in that show.
Yeah.
And the question comes up, I haven't watched the show, but I'm guessing that the question comes up often in zombie things, how characters react to the potential of their transition to being in this afterlife. Because in World War Z, for example, there are certain characters who sort of preempt that everyone's going to go there, and then they sort of almost commit themselves to one guy pulls out his teeth so he's not, you know, he just can't eat people, you know. This is kind of a weird sort of reaction to that. So there's a kind of preemption of the afterlife.
Sure. It's here that probably some exploration into Freud becomes useful. Strangely enough, Freud features quite greatly in my book on zombies. When he was outlining his theories of psychoanalysis, one of the things that he talked about was a thing called the death drive, hence the name of the original blog post that spawned this whole thing, Death Drive Jesus.
Right.
To put it simply, Freud actually sort of said that, you know, we are not simply biological beings. Even though we are fundamentally biology, we still try to bring some sense of infinity into our biological drives.
Right.
When we do that, we actually are willing to do that and desire to do that, even if it kills us.
Right.
Right. So we are willing to bring that infinity into our lives, and we are willing to actually do even harm to our own biological lives for the sake of that infinity. Mm. So there's that thing, like, we want to pursue heaven even if it kills us. So there's a really weird materiological turn when it comes to the life of the undead.
Which comes back to where you went at the start of the show, which is the connection between the Eucharist and Christ. So let's bring it home now in terms of that particular connection, because lots of people are out there going, okay, you can see stuff in zombie movies. Where does it bring Catholics? Where does it bring us back to this incarnational reality?
Sure. There's a couple of things that we can focus on. The first is precisely this incarnational logic.
Physical beings, we're enfleshed.
We are enfleshed.
And it matters.
And that matters, but not only that, it also matters when it comes to our salvation. One of the things I bring out in the book, hence the title Redeeming Flesh, it was a sort of play on the on words. We are not just redeemed in terms of being redeemed by the flesh of somebody that is, you know, that is other than us, namely the flesh of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. But that when Jesus Christ comes to redeem us, he also redeems our flesh.
So right.
So that
we're not
our
just saved
bodies,
by flesh, we're saved. Our in flesh the is flesh. Saved.
That's right. We are saved in the flesh as well. So it is important that we, you know, that we understand the fullness of what redemption means. Redemption doesn't just mean some spiritual thing that only happens in our insides and while we wait for our bodies to die.
Mm.
It's actually something that happens in our bodily lives, in the here and now. And so there's that twofold dimension in our bodily lives and in the here and now that we really must sort of like focus our attention to when it comes to, you know, reflecting upon what it means to be redeemed by Christ. That's the first thing. The other thing that comes out when we talk about flesh and bodies is that it's not simply biological bodies that get redeemed. There is also another theme in...
Because that's the zombie thing, isn't it? The zombie comes back as a body, but not with their mind or their consciousness.
Correct. And yet, the the sort of like the power of the zombie doesn't just come from the fact that it does its eating in isolation, right? It, on its own, a zombie doesn't really have very much, for want of a better term, powers. The
threat.
Power
it's only not a big threat.
Threat, right. The threat only comes when they come in huge numbers.
Right.
So there is a sort of exploration there of the how should I put it? The power of social bodies, not just biological bodies. And sort of like in contradistinction to that, there's a sort of exploration of the redeeming power of social bodies in and amongst the survivors.
Right. Right?
It's a sort of line that you see in another one of my favorite theologians, a guy by the name of Stanley Hauerwas, said in a homily that in the Old Testament, it wasn't just that people were saved by God, but that they were saved by God by being constituted as a people.
So God brings them together as a people and brings the people to himself.
That's right. And in the gathering.
They're not individual sort of individual salvation.
Correct. And in the gathering, you are saved.
Right.
The zombie genre is really good in exploring the two sides of that saving. Like on the one hand, you have the saving power of the gathering, right? Mm. The gathering survivors. Whilst at the same time, you see the inverse of that, which is the destructive power of a horn, the zombie horn, when life is not present
right
anymore.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff we'd like to go with. I mean, there's also the pop culture stuff of Resident Evil and Evil Dead and these comedy sort of things. Mm-hmm. But we are out of time, so I'd like to push this a little further. I'd like to have you back, Matthew, and talk about some other ideas you've had about pop culture, like the internet.
I want you to convince me that when we're on the internet, we're not being zombies. So maybe we could have another episode just on that.
Or when we're using our phones.
I am not a robot.
We're using our phones. We talk about bots and sort of the robots. Mm-hmm. Element. That'd be an interesting one to look at. And you've written a really cool essay called The Internet as a Form of Prayer, which I'd love to explore with you on another episode.
That'll be great.
Yeah, that'll
be great.
But the sort of wrap-up question is, this genre isn't really for everyone, but there's something in it, and it's one of the pop culture expressions of genuine yearning in the human spirit for theology. It strikes me as the incarnation is not just a crazy Catholic idea, but this is evidence that it goes in as part of the human condition.
That's right. We are constantly haunted by the incarnation, even when we deny it explicitly.
Yeah. Have you ever had, and I've already had this experience, but I wonder if you've had it, when this conversation comes up, you can talk to people about really deep theological matters precisely because you have a shared
narrative.
A shared narrative. Yeah. I actually do that a lot with anime.
Right.
And one of the explorations.
There's another show.
That is another show. Absolutely. And I am sort of working on an article that looks at the theological virtues in the light of one particular anime director. My favorite ones. A guy by the name of Makoto Shinkai. I think that was actually explored in a talk somewhere.
I'm just impressed that it's obvious that you can say that name so well.
It's because I'm Asian.
I know. I'm so jealous. I have Asian energy.
It's funny, when Box gave us his explanation of his name in our first episode, it took me about four goes to actually be able to pronounce it. I'm just so useless. Now, just for the listener, say it again.
What is the name?
The name.
Makoto Shinkai.
Awesome.
It's just beautiful.
It is. All right, so we go on. What you were saying about him?
I forgot what I was going to say about him.
You're writing an article about him.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes. So I was writing an article about Makoto Shinkai and his movies. He's actually released a new movie, which I'm excited about.
This means you can't finish your paper yet.
Which means I cannot finish my paper yet. I need to re-edit it again. And it sort of explores, more graphically than, through sort of spoken discourse, the themes of faith, hope, and love.
Mm.
As explored in the papal encyclicals. So that was the way I'm trying to explore that.
I think it's interesting that the further away we get from having a sort of a conscious and quite obvious cultural commitment to Christianity, the more religion ends up being expressed in pop culture.
That's right. And you actually find that many of the purveyors of pop culture are actually better theologians than most theologians.
It's a great cause for hope.
Absolutely.
I think culture. So. And yeah. engagement too. It's a real good cause for engagement. And if we drop out of these things just because they're a little bit off and we're not our thing, I think we miss that opportunity.
No, that's right. And there's also this other thing. You can't really check out of, you know, of culture, culture and cultural exploration. Mm. You know, trying to check out of culture for the sake of faith is trying to check out of the weather for the sake of faith.
Isn't it just the Benedict option?
Oh, another show, another conversation.
Eject. Checking out of culture. withdraw.
We could go with monastic life there too.
That's different.
Even monastic life is not checking out of culture.
Exactly.
It's just that's choice right. of
Especially
a particular culture.
Especially not checking out of culture.
No, that's right.
Again, another show.
Sure.
It's time now for a segment we call 1 Minute Wonder. This is where we share something we've seen, heard, or experienced this week that makes us stop and wonder, something that made us smile or just appreciate life a little more. Renee.
There has been a lot of laughter in our house because we have discovered a new BBC show, which is called Upstart Crow, and that's a reference to Shakespeare. It is this fantastic show where they're basically taking the Mickey out of everything Shakespearean in a really affectionate way. So everything to do with Shakespeare scholarship. So for example, I'll just give two quick examples. One is that there's this whole thing going on about, you know, Shakespeare didn't really exist, and if he did, he didn't write his own plays, and probably Christopher Marlowe wrote some of them or someone else. Anyway, in this particular show, there are 3 seasons of it so far, it's not that Marlowe wrote Shakespeare's plays, but Shakespeare wrote the first three of Marlowe's plays, and that's how Marlowe became really big. So there's that going on. But also there are all of these pop culture references. For example, oh my gosh, Dad, that would be like if someone came up with a show, says the surly teenager to Shakespeare, where people were just wandering around saying, oh my gosh, I think I'm dead, but I'm probably alive, or am I alive, or am I dead? Which I thought was quite appropriate because it was a reference to zombies and how people would not want to watch any shows like this. And of course, the joke on us is that people like zombies in mm-hmm. contemporary culture. Anyway.
Matthew.
My 1 Minute Wonder was actually revisiting the hymn Be Thou My Vision.
Oh, wow.
There was a YouTube video by a guy named Sam Robson who sang Be Thou My Vision a cappella in 4 parts. So it was sort of like a
quartet?
No, it was there's a specific, a splicing of the 4 parts.
Right.
Yeah. It's musically well done. It's top notch. But what it also brought home was the last 2 lines of the entire hymn, which when listening to it actually brought tears to my eyes. Mm. Which was the 2 lines: "Heart of my own heart, whatever befall, still be my vision, O ruler of all."
Cool.
And it sort of rammed home to me the sort of crux of the faith. Our faith is the faith of the heart, and we seek after the heart of God.
Hmm.
So much so that when we do that, we do not fear things that befall us, or we actually do fear the things that befall us, but that, you know, that heart that fears is also caught up in the much larger, safer heart of God.
Wonderful.
That's beautiful.
Mine's a bit more basic. I had a really rotten day yesterday, and I went home and one of my kids said, "Oh, why are you in such a good mood?" And I thought, why am I in such a good mood? I don't understand. I was trying to think back at all the things that happened. I realized there was one phone call on the way home in which someone said, "You're doing a good job," just once. And all the crap in the day couldn't change the fact that I felt awesome when I got home. And even though I was exhausted and yeah, it wasn't a great day, I still felt great. So to all those at you who think that a small thing is affirming someone, it's big. It's really big. So keep it going. That's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking, arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast at our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, or what you'd like us to discuss in a future episode. I want to say thank you at this point to those of you who have done so. We've been getting lots of great feedback, and especially good ideas for new shows. You can continue this conversation by joining our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Discord chats, or you can find the show notes on our website. Be sure to write us a review on iTunes. Actually write the review and give us a rating. because that helps other people find us. It helps us to become more noticed in this sphere. This is a uniquely Australian Catholic podcast, and we think that's an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends. Before we go, it's time for shout-outs. Renee.
I want to send a shout-out to nurses. I've just been discovering more and more that a lot of our students who are studying nursing are falling in love with philosophy and theology. And so I'm in this really difficult position because I'm saying, we need good nurses. But at the same time, I'm like, why didn't you come study with her? So anyway, no, a good nurse is just an amazing, amazing person. And I just want to send a shout out to all of those nurses working around the clock for so many of us.
Yes. Matthew.
Pandas.
Pandas.
I am giving a shout out to pandas. There is no reason for you to exist, and yet you exist anyway, which means you are actually demonstrating God's infinite love for the world.
Go pandas. Isn't a panda some kind of Asian creature you should love passionately? For some reason.
I just have been catalogued and pigeonholed and I'm feeling offended.
We almost went through the whole episode without a...
We just had to throw one in there at the end. Sorry, Peter.
That's all right.
We were pretty good, actually.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I lost my shout out.
You can shout out to pandas too.
No, I don't like pandas. In fact, when they made, they brought panda characters into one of the games I used to play, I went, no. It's not even really, the Kung Fu Panda thing went wild in computer games. Yeah, oh, give me a break.
That's racist.
Speciesist. All right, I'm going to finish there. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to This Catholic Life.
I'm leaving it all in.
Oh, that was fun.
That was really fun.